The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 101, Robert Frost and My Spiritual Understanding in Life, by Albert Eugene Peck.
Devotional. I'm Albert Peck, the editor of Sunstone Magazine, and today we're talking about Robert Frost. The title, as it's in the program, is Robert Frost and My Spiritual Understanding in Life. First time I encountered Robert Frost that I remember was my mission. I remember hearing a state president in a state conference quote the famous line, "I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in the wood, and I took the one less traveled by." And that made all the difference. Of course, he used it in a context where the choice that one took was right and wrong, good and evil. But it resonated with me as a missionary, even though that's not how Frost meant it in the poem. And all of a sudden, you know how it goes once you hear a quote. I kept hearing that quote everywhere, and I ran into it in Richard L. Evans' quote book, which I read on my mission also. And I kept thinking, this Robert Frost, I need to find this Robert Frost. So later on my mission, I purchased a copy of this book, of the poetry of Robert Frost. Since then, that copy has disappeared, and this is maybe my third copy of Robert Frost, but which I lament, because it had all these marginal notes that I started writing as a missionary. I would read Frost and find great resonance with the world as I saw it as a missionary. The famous poems about snow, his poem in his first book of poems called Trial by Existence, which says that we lived in a premortal life, and everything that we experienced here in this life we chose before we came here, clearly would ring true with a missionary. And in fact, to end off my mission, as I was an assistant to the president, just before I left my mission, I had to take a tour of zone conferences. So I memorized this poem, and I memorized this verse at the end of a poem to describe my feelings about my mission, sort of in my farewell speech, which went, when to the heart of man, was it ever less than a treason to go with the drift of things, to yield with a grace to reason, to bow and accept the end of a love or a season? I came home from my mission, and I'd fairly well read through the book with all my little marginal notes, and didn't do much. But I took a class from Arthur Henry King, an English professor at BYU, and he extolled the virtues of memorizing texts as the only way to learn them and to understand them. And he converted me to that idea. So the first poem I memorized after my mission was The Touch of the Master's Hand. Anyone want me to recite that one right now?
That's probably not what Arthur meant either.
It's probably not what Arthur meant. But only in the book of Robert Frost poetry, and having read through it once, I soon started to include Robert Frost in the poems I'd memorize. The way I would memorize these poems was walking to and from campus. I lived in King Henry Apartments, which is over a mile from campus, I guess. And I would take these 3x5 note cards and photocopy a poem and put it on the note card, and I would just read it and work on reciting it with no force, just up and back, early in the morning, at lunchtime, late at night. And after a while, I memorized the poems. I was also able to get into the poem. Once you've read a poem in the dawn as it's bursting over the hill, when you're weary, going home at night, it's cloudy, overcast, when it's hot in the summer, when you're tired, when you're optimistic, when you're hopeful, when you're depressed. Some poems will stand up to all those different readings and moods and tensions and contexts, and you're able to, it bends with you and you get new light and new interpretation. Other poems aren't quite so bendable, and they don't give way to those kind of multiple interpretations. Some of Frost's poems do one and some of Frost's poems do the other. So that is how I became acquainted with Robert Frost. I think over the course I memorized maybe 100 poems. Everything from the little couplet, which is a poem in itself, which says, "We dance around a ring and suppose, but the circle sits." Excuse me. We dance around a circle and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows. That's perhaps the shortest poem. I would memorize poems that would deal with
alienation. There's one called Desert Places that talks about, as I interpreted it as a missionary, and then when I memorized it later, the apostasy that is coming over the world that is putting ruining all difference, but also being haunted by one's own desert places inside, and how that is more scary than the apostasy you see going on around you, which clearly is what I saw going on around me while I was at BYU. not just because of the, you know, being Mormon at BYU, the rest of the world is going to hell. That's not that BYU was in apostasy. Not at least I didn't see it when I was there. I always had that poem, Desert Places. Snow falling and night falling fast. Oh, fast in a field I looked into going past. And the ground around me covered smooth with snow, save a few weeds and stubble showing last. The woods around it have it. It is theirs. All animals are smothered in their lairs. I am too absent spirited to count. The loneliness includes me unawares. And lonely as it is, it will be more lonely ere it will be less. A blanker whiteness of benighted snow with no expression, nothing to express. They cannot scare me with their empty places, empty spaces between stars, on stars where no human race is. I have it in me so much nearer home to scare myself with my own desert places. That's one of the poems I memorized there. As I matured as an undergraduate and became an upperclassman and then a graduate student, I began to see the world not so much in black and white and good or bad, but struggling with my own depressions of feelings of inadequacy and not being good enough, which I think is a common malady that afflicts BYU students. I began to see in many of the poems I memorized what has been called the darker side of Frost's poems. He was perhaps America's popular poet during his life because he was sentimentalized and seemed to be this cheery person who would write these nice poems about stopping by woods and seeing the snow and such. But even that poem, and certainly most of his others, have another side to them. And there's also a philosophy that's one of not sure about God, but talks about God a lot in his poems. They're deeply embedded with religious symbolism throughout. Very skeptical of human nature, fundamentally liking them, but not sure. Being very aware of the tensions in human life and writing about them. And I don't know if those things became articulated in my life because Robert Frost would articulate those issues and then I would see them in my life, or if I was already identifying and dealing with those issues and I went to Robert Frost and stayed with him because I felt those issues were growing in me. In any event, I came to use many of the categories of Frost to understand the world and how I should approach it, and understand people, and when I would see situations, he has a beautiful poem about a tension between a husband and a wife and how they have a hard time communicating. You know, when I would date and those kind of tensions, I would understand the silences between people and things. So that's how I came to. So I've been very much influenced by Robert Frost. I remember later, once I was as a custodian one summer in the Washington Temple. I was late at night by myself on this ladder down in the baptistry, washing these gigantic windows that separate the baptismal font from a little theater that looks in on it. And I was going away, singing a song or something while I'm washing these windows. All of a sudden, there's something there, and it startles me. And I'm afraid. I'm scared. And then I realize it's just my own shadow. And I merely thought, that's exactly the sort of image Frost would write a poem about, and use it as a metaphor of for other things in life. And Frost introduced me to the concept of metaphor, you know, speaking in terms of one thing, speaking about one thing in terms of another. He actually believed all language, all communication, even scientific language, was at root metaphorical. That began helping me. I began finding my own metaphors in most of my sacrament talks at that time, or whatever lessons were metaphor based. I remember going to hear the Utah Symphony at the Marriott Center and seeing all the different instruments playing and the tempo and the thing. And I gave the sacrament talk on how being in the church is just like a symphony, you know, and we've got different people, and some play a lot and some don't play, and just, but you got to have someone leading the scoring, beating the tune. And I was somewhat a little more like Edgar Guest in pulling out all of the implications and analogies than Frost. But he introduced me to metaphor, which has been a ruling concept in my life, and it's helped me deal with concepts of myth when I entered them in religion, and also all the postmodern ideas concerning language and how we know and what we can ultimately know and what and not know. Metaphor resonates with that a lot, and Frost put me in on that. Some of his poems are metaphors, but they're somewhat obvious. One approach to life that I've sort of learned on my own, I think, but Frost gave it a name and labeled it and articulated it and said this is a good approach to life, is when there is chaos in the world around you, the best thing to do is to not get caught up in the passions of the rush of the moment, but to be able to step back and let everything go by and then take stock of what was important, what wasn't afterwards. That came at a crucial time in my life, several times. Once when I was at Seventh East Press, which was a short-lived independent student newspaper at BYU. And it was a very heady time working there. We lived in the apartment, which was also the office of the newspaper. And so 24 hours a day, we're dealing with these issues of all the malfeasance in contemporary church administration and at BYU. And we're in a study group that's looking at all the things in history that were different than we grew up beginning believing. And the rush of disillusionment and lots of friends quitting the church. And it was a physically exhausting period, an emotionally exhausting period, and intellectually stimulating, but also wearying. And I was just getting burned out. And I finally fled from that situation. It was an exhilarating situation at the time, and I took a step back from it, and clearly saying this is a Frostian thing that I'm doing. He wrote a little ditty about that. Here it goes. It's called "One Step Backward Taken." Not only sand and gravels were once more on their travels, but gulping muddy gallons, great boulders off their balance, bumped heads together dully and started down the gully. Whole capes kicked off in slices. I felt my standpoint shaken in the universal crisis. But with one step backward taken, I saved myself from going. A world torn loose went by me. And then rain stopped, and the blowing, and the sun came out to dry me. Now the question is, getting in and understanding poems and understanding the poet by reading them, so many of them, and having them speak to each other and speak to you and speak to your life's experience because they're so ready at your hand. You use phrases from Frost all the time to articulate experiences. Another one that happened to me was once later, I had visited BYU campus, and it was a nostalgic visit. And I had sort of become a little more world-weary at that time, and visiting BYU was painful and also good. I was remembering the simple life that I had there compared to where I was now. And I went to the Fine Arts Center, which where my wards met, my stake met, and sneak my way into the Pardo Theater where we'd have sacrament meeting and priesthood meeting. I remember sitting on the edge of the stage, and like there's just one or two lights on in the room, looking out into the rows there and remembering all the sweet people who were in the ward in which I was in, and where I was Elders Quorum president and very intimately involved in their lives. And remember fond times and the great love and wonderful individuals, and thinking on how happy I was at that time in the community and how alienated I felt both from the Mormon community and my faith at that time. And I started to cry, and tears started coming down my face. And the closing line from a Frost poem was called Directive, which is a person who's seeking some revelation in his life, came to me, and it said, "Here are your waters and your watering place. Drink and be whole again beyond confusion." You know, everyone was telling me, you get fed and you get watered from your Mormon community, and you need to drink from that. It was sort of a personal revelation to me at the time, and the revelation came in the words of Robert Frost, because that was the language I knew, and the metaphors that were important to me. I'm happy to recite a few more poems. I actually enjoyed doing that, but recitation is not easy for me. I hated memorizing the discussions on my mission, and because I was in an English mission, I didn't really have to. I could do things in my own words, and even though that's a policy of the church now for missionaries, it wasn't back then. You're supposed to memorize every little word. I felt very guilty not doing that, and memorizing was hard for me. It was hard for me when I came back from my mission. I can testify to the Emerson quote that Heber Grant made, almost Mormon scripture. That which we persist in doing becomes easier, not because the nature of the task has changed, but because our ability to do it has increased. I didn't force myself to memorize poems. I savored them as I would read them, and I read them often enough that it came second nature, and then I think, I've got this enough, I can try without the card, and I get stuck. But it wasn't like when I had to memorize those stupid scriptures for like priesthood advancement. You know, you're supposed to do one a quarter, but it's, December 28th, and you've got to have it memorized by the end of the year in order to get your, whatever the annual award was that led to your duty to God award. Anyhow, that was hard. And even that was helpful because they had picked one scripture, which was from section 121. You know, we have learned by sad experience that, many are called but few are chosen. And why are they not chosen? Because their hearts are so set on the things of this world, inspired with the highest honors of men, that they do not learn this one lesson. It goes on and on and on. I memorized that passage. It's become such a crucial passage in my life in terms of understanding how people and organizations work and what God expects of us and calls us to it. And had I never memorized that passage, I would know it's in the scripture, but it wouldn't have been so much a part of me, and my life would be in such conversation with it that I would use it as an interpretive tool to understand so much around me. But I memorized a lot more Robert Frost than I memorized scripture. Although I did once, during the same time at BYU, try to memorize the entire Sermon on the Mount, three chapters of Matthew. I never totally got it down. But spending a year returning to it again and again and reading the Sermon on the Mount as I'm going backwards and forwards to campus, that is also a fundamental text for me in my life. The phrases and the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, to not resist evil and to love your enemies, they are so much with me and in conversation with me, and I quote them so readily when I come to issues that deal with them, as they have also had an important part. Now, we're told, and sometimes we talk about obtaining the mind of God or the mind of Christ. I don't really know what that means, but having lived part of my life in the company of Robert Frost, I think I somewhat understand the Robert Frost, and somewhat have acquired the mind of Robert Frost because I've immersed myself so in him. And Shakespeare has Cromwell lamenting at the end of his life, if he'd only served his God half as well as he'd served his king, God would not have left him in his miserable state at the end of life. Is it true for me if I'd only serve God in memorizing scriptures instead of memorizing Robert Frost, but I have more of the mind of God in me than I have of the mind of Robert Frost? I think that's an important question. Wayne Booth, in his book, The Company We Keep and Ethics of Fiction, deals with that same issue. The company that we keep, books that we read, do have an impact on us. That book is a delightful book, which I recommend to everyone, and it's Wayne Booth's journey in his lifelong conversation with Mark Twain, who he loved and celebrated, and his later criticism came to call it racist, fundamentally racist. He had to sort of acknowledge a lot of that. What then does he do with it? But a lot of his understanding of literature has been through his focused conversation with Mark Twain and his writings. We are so much affected by the company that we keep. And I'm not sure whether my company with Robert Frost, well, it's been delightful, I still like doing it, was the best company. All I know is that it certainly is better than Edgar Guest. someone whose company to keep. And curiously, Robert Frost was threatened by Edgar Guest, who was another popular person who was on the circuit reading his poems, and Frost was jealous and envious of Guest because he thought Guest was more beloved and thought more highly by the American public than himself, which is strange to think of today. But and certainly was a fear of Frost, and because he was a petty man in many ways, yes. So those are sort of my thoughts on what we become by the company we keep, and I've kept the company of Robert Frost. I can say with him I've been one acquainted with the night, and but I also have a lover's quarrel with the world, and his concepts work for me. We've got a few minutes, I can recite some poems, or if anyone else wants to sort of make a comment, then we can make this like a Sunday school class. Yes.
I have the pleasure of meeting Robert. When I say I met him, I put that, that's very frivolous to say, he met with a bunch of students after his convocation, and he gave a few insights. One was, in regards to something you just said too, about reading the margins in his poetry. He said, don't read the margins that anyone else has written about his poetry. Just read my poems. And he also mentioned that as your life changes, his poems will change. And then one person, and he recited all his poems from memory that he gave, because he gave us approximately an hour of just reciting his poems. And there was one jerk of a student who was following along, and he noticed that there were some changes that he had in his in a couple of his poems. And he asked him, and his answer was just very simple. He said, "Even Robert Frost changes."
Yeah.
And I just thought I should share that.
Thank you. Anyone else have a comment? Yes.
Albert, I'm wondering if you could give us the name of that Wayne Booth book again.
Called The Company We Keep, An Ethics of Fiction.
I want to hear you recite another poem.
Okay, anyone have one they want me to recite? Then,
I've got to finish.
Well, the time, yeah, didn't realize that, but I'm going to have to use some prompts too, I think, for that one. There's a phrase in it, I had problems. This is a fun poem, which is a metaphor about life and about literature, and he wrote for all his books, so he liked it so much it became the invitation to read his poems that was put at the front of all of his books, and he's at the front of any collection of his books. It's called The Pasture. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too.
Yeah. Was there a poem that's on your mind a little more now than in past years? On your mind keep you learning too? Or was there one you'd like to leave as a benediction?
Benediction poem. This one in his last book, which I like, I don't know if it's a good benediction poem, but it's not, he didn't title it, but so it's titled by a collector, it's called In Winter in the Woods. It goes, "In winter in the woods alone, against the trees I go. I mark a maple for my own and lay a maple low. At 4 o'clock I shoulder axe, and in the afterglow I link the line of shadowy tracks across the tinted snow. I see for nature 90 feet and one tree's overthrow, or for myself in my retreat for yet another blow."
He had one called "To Prayer I Go."
Oh, yes. I have not memorized that one.
He was deeply troubled by that loss of one's.
Yes, I can find that. "To Prayer I Go." I know it, I just don't have it memorized, but I'm happy to read it. It's not here under "To Prayer I Go," so I can't remember what the title is. So I need the first line at least. In the meantime, yes? "To Transcendental Time." It's a beautiful poem. It's about, well, I don't need to say what it's about. It's about two tramps who come to a man who's chopping wood. And clearly, they need money. They're unemployed. And this man is chopping wood for delight. And he's in the dilemma of, is it right for me to continue chopping wood when I only do it for the pleasure of it, when these people need to do it for their earnings? I have memorized a stanza for it, which I did at BYU, because it sort of identified my desire to take desperate drives and moves and to combine them together. It's the end of the poem. It's called, "But yield the world to their separation,
My object in living is to unite my avocation with my vocation, as my two eyes make one in sight. For only where love and need are one, and work is play for motive stakes, is the deed ever really done for human, for heaven and the future's sakes. Frost believed in love and need being one, and that's been an important metaphor for me. Yes.
Would you be kind enough to explain to anonymous your interpretation of
Love and Question? I'd have to read it again. I haven't memorized it, so I don't know that poem so well that I can just spout out about it.
I'll meet you
up. Okay, great. We'll take the book and go over it. Anyone else? Yes?
Do you have at your tongue tip the couplet on the jokes on baby and on baby?
Yeah, well, it's a close paraphrase. I'll forgive my real joke. Dear God, please forgive. I'll forgive my real jokes on me if you forgive your one big joke on me. Yes.
One of my favorite lines is from The Death of the Hired Man. Home is a place where you don't have to deserve to be.
That's right. That's a conversation between the man and the woman on home, and because this man has come home, it says to work basically come home to die. Home is a place where you don't have to deserve to be there. That's what the man says. That's what the woman says. And the man's reply is, he says it first, is home is where when you go there, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. Yes. Anyone else? We are almost out of time. Okay, well, that's really fun. Are you? Oh, you're just saying thumbs up. Thank you. Those are thoughts. It's company we keep, affects your spiritual life. And much of my views in religion are linked or expressed through the metaphors of